Hi, BBs. Welcome to this week's episode of the Burn Black Audio Zine. I am your host, B, as always, and welcome to our collective where we discuss mental health, wellness, and spirituality each week. How are you guys doing? We made it to Aquarius season. It's my favorite season of the year. It's my birthday season, not to brag. And I'm really excited. Aquarius season gives us more of an opportunity to think of others in our community and how we can make the world a better place. As cheesy as it sounds, the world really needs us right now. It's on fire. It's dying. And we're not being so kind to the world right now. So how can we work to lead a more humanitarian life? It could be as simple as when we're brushing our teeth, you know, not letting the water run, maybe being a little bit more adaptable in how we get along with others at work when we feel frustrated. How can we think of new innovative ideas to make our life run smoother and make the people around us happier? How can we be more considerate of the people that we love and the people in our lives and the people that we commute with? So just making little small changes in our everyday routine, even if they seem very tiny, if we're all doing that on a universal scale, that can create huge change. So in a very scary time with the Saturn-Pluto conjunction and a very uneasy world on fire, let's work on trying to just be a little bit more kinder and understanding of the people in our lives and making these small changes. Maybe just investing in a water bottle. Maybe something so simple can just have a little impact. You know, we often think that we don't have a lot of value in the sense that this universe is so humongous. Like, what can we do to really change anything? But here's the truth. Even the smallest things that we do can have huge impact. If we're thinking about the idea of generational trauma, ancestral trauma, and the little things that have really affected our attachment styles and our nervous systems and things like that, when we really explore that, we can see how the smallest things that keep getting repeated generationally have these huge impacts. So why not turn that around and start adapting some more healthy patterns, and more healthy patterns for the environment, healthy patterns for our families and the people that we work with and the people in our neighborhoods and the people in the cities that we live in. If we all just try a little bit harder to have a little bit more understanding and to, you know, give without wanting to receive anything back, just giving from the goodness of our hearts, you know, understanding that we are all one person in different forms. Like, when you hurt someone else, no matter if you like them or not, you are hurting another part of this ecosystem. So maybe leading a little bit more with love this season would be a great way to really impact that Aquarius in your chart, wherever it may be. So that's just something I'm gonna try applying to my own life. I hope to encourage some of you guys to do the same. And that's how I'm celebrating this Aquarius season. So this week on the audio zine, I really wanted to discuss medical trauma for a long time. You know, when we think of PTSD, we often think of severe trauma, people who lose somebody close to them, somebody who has a very tumultuous experience that causes a lot of pain, People who come from really broken homes or broken environments. We think about people who go to war, but PTSD can affect anybody, and medical trauma is part of that, and it's often overlooked. Imagine having a normal day where you're supposed to get up and go to a wedding and celebrate, and then just being in piercing pain, and the next thing you know, you are in the hospital getting cut open out of nowhere. That's pretty traumatizing. And then having a major surgery and having to adjust, I mean, that can take up like a year, like it take more than a year. Your body is really experiencing something. You have to disconnect a little bit when you're in pain, let alone having a major surgery out of nowhere. Wow, like imagine experiencing that, because that is something we're going to talk about today with our guest, Millie DeCherico, who had this happen to her about a year and a half ago. She had a major surgery, and when she went to go and start her healing process on a physical level, she started to begin to see the way it really impacted her on a mental level. And Millie, being a pretty positive person her whole life, never really thought that this is something she could feel. So when she started to evaluate spaces to really talk about medical PTSD, she really found a lack of resources other than Reddit. So today we are talking not only about her emergency surgery and how all that went down, but we're also going to really talk about the lack of spaces there are and what we can do to really change that. I hope that Burn Black can be one of the many places where we can go to discuss this, because this is something no one's talking about, guys. So let's talk about it. So I'm really anxious and excited to bring you this guest. And then later on in the episode, I have a friend of mine named John Hanning, who is an amazing visual artist, who tells his 5-minute diagnosis story about his 1995 diagnosis of AIDS and how the words "fuck you" epically helped him survive. It's a really empowering story, so stick around. This is my interview with Millie. Millie is an Aries sun, an Aquarius moon, and a Libra rising. Hey, Millie, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing really good. How's the weather in California?
It's great. It's just really dry right now, so my skin is on fire, basically. But other than that, pretty good.
It's pretty freezing here. Yesterday, it started snowing. And usually when it snows in the Midwest, it actually means the weather, like it actually gets warmer.
Oh, wow.
But it was rare. It was cold, windy, and snow yesterday. So, So I wanted to talk a little bit today about medical trauma, how that relates to the mind. And you went through a pretty crazy experience, which you wrote about on Instagram as it was happening.
Yeah.
Was it last year?
Yeah, it was last year. It's been a little over a year. It happened end of November of 2018. A little over a year.
Okay, I'm going to allow you to tell the story, but I guess we'll get into some of the stuff that happened with the healing process afterwards, but how did it all begin, Millie?
So I have to point out that I always have to say this because it really contributes to like the reaction that I had after everything was happening. So, you know, I had never been to the hospital before. I had never had a surgery before. I had been to the hospital, I think, once or twice with some friends of mine, like when in my 20s, when I just kind of went with them in the middle of the night because they had an illness or they broke a bone or something. So for me, I was lucky to have been relatively healthy before this point. Like I didn't have any chronic illnesses. And I mean, I'm 40, so I'm very lucky in that regard. So I would say it was probably the week before Thanksgiving of 2018. I had gone to a wedding. I had some friends in town for the wedding, and then, you know, they left, and I was going on with my life and was just feeling kind of run down and kind of didn't know what was going on. I just assumed it was a hangover because I just was like, oh, well, I've been partying all weekend. So maybe, you know, and I'm not in my 20s anymore. So maybe I'm just tired. And I just felt like I was coming down with something. And so it was actually on Thanksgiving. I was supposed to go out, you know, to some friends of mine's house out in the burbs, basically. And they have a baby, and I was just going to go and spend Thanksgiving with them. And the morning of Thanksgiving, I woke up and I thought, oh, I think I might have a fever. I don't really know what's going on. I feel kind of like feverish. So I took my temperature, and essentially it was like this really low grade fever. It was probably like 99.5 or like 99.7. So I was like, how strange is that? Maybe it's just a fluke. And so then I just got ready and was getting ready to go over there. And then, like, for another reason or something, I took my temperature again before I left. And, it was now like at 100.2. So again, like not a huge fever, but definitely a fever. So I was like, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't go. And so I called my friends and I said, you know, I have this like low grade fever. And they're like, okay, yeah, don't come. We have a baby. Like, it's a nightmare when they get around, people who are sick. I was like, all right, no problem. So from that point, I would say like Thanksgiving throughout the weekend, I was just on the couch with a low grade fever. I just felt like I had the flu. Like I was like, you know, I had the chills, my body hurt. I mean, I wasn't like feeling hungry. I just felt like shit, basically. And on, I think it was the Saturday or Sunday of the weekend, you know, of that weekend, I was like, all right, fuck this. I have to like see if I really have the flu. And so I went to, I have this like FaceTime doctor service that's provided by my insurance company. And they're always sending me emails about it. And they were basically like, oh yeah, you can see a doctor over FaceTime and it's super easy. And they'll just give you the prescription or whatever. So I was like, all right, let me just try that. So I got online with this like FaceTime doctor, and I told him all my symptoms, and he was like, it sounds like you have the flu. Let me prescribe you some Tamiflu, which is, you know, flu medication. And I was like, okay. So I went to the pharmacist, filled a prescription. It was like $100, and I was really pissed off about that, but whatever. So I took the medication, and then from that point, it was like, I wasn't feeling better. It just was like, I was starting to have like weird stomach problems. Like I was like in the bathroom a lot and just feeling rotten and having like, you know, terrible nights of sleep. And I was just like, all right, maybe it's just the medicine. You know, I've never been like really good with like antibiotics. So like maybe this is what's happening. I mean, I'm literally thinking I just like have the flu. I really don't know what else there was. So, you know, Monday, Tuesday come go by and I'm like not feeling any better. So Tuesday afternoon, I wake up in the morning, I'm like taking the dog out. I'm just, you know, alternating between like Tylenol and Advil and like drinking, you know, juices and soups. And I'm just like, what the fuck is going on? And so I was on the couch watching TV and I was kind of like laying on my side and, you know, I've been coughing sort of intermittently throughout the week. And so I started coughing and immediately felt this pop.
Oh my goodness.
And it was kind of, it was in my life. It definitely was like, it felt like it was happening within my like lady parts region. So like lower abdomen near the like, you know, I thought I basically had ruptured like an ovary or had some cyst burst or something like that. Cause that's where it felt like it was really low in my body. And so I was thinking, oh my God, I don't know what's going on. So, but it was a pain that I had like never felt before in my entire life. I mean, it just felt like unbelievably painful. And so, you know, I called my neighbor and I was like, is there any way you can take me to the hospital? And he came over, he drove me into the hospital. I waited in the waiting room for a while. It was like super painful to sit down. I mean, I just was like, I mean, I really did think that I had done something sort of with my reproductive system, right? So I get, you know, after a few hours in the emergency room, I'm in the back, I'm in the hallway, because they didn't have any beds. So I was in the hallway on a stretcher, basically. And, you know, they were asking me all these questions. And then they, like, took me to, they were doing blood work, and they took me to, you know, get a CT scan and all that stuff. And then pretty much immediately came back after the scans and said, we have to take you to surgery. Because you have some kind of thing ruptured in your abdomen, and you actually have like bacteria that's all over your abdomen. So we got to go like right now. And that was pretty much like,
you know, how did you react?
Like, I just was like, okay, I don't know what's going on. And they, at that point, you know, they put me on like the heavy pain stuff. So I was kind of like loopy and out of it. But I just remember I went into surgery, and I remember right beforehand, like, because I was being seen by like a lot of doctors, and they were kind of like telling me what was going on, but they didn't kind of tell me everything. And so basically they were like, you had an abscess in this one part of your abdomen, which is called the mesentery. And I had no idea what this was until it happened. But basically it was, it's the tissues that connect your intestines to your body. So it's like, I think it's technically an organ, but it's really just kind of like a collection of like blood vessels and tissues and stuff that is like connecting your lower and upper intestine to the walls of your body. So I ended up having two surgeries, because what happened is there was an abscess in there that exploded, essentially, which is what that pop felt like. And and then it was basically like there was all this like bacteria, and I was actually in septic shock. And so they were like, we have to do one surgery. We have to cut you open, do the surgery. We're going to keep you open overnight and do a second surgery just to make sure we got everything. Cause I guess it was really bad. And that's kind of what happened. And, I later found out, cause I was in the hospital for about 2 weeks, that essentially it was caused by a benign tumor that I had in the mesentery that I didn't know how I got, and I didn't know how long it'd been there. It was just sort of like there hanging out. And it just kind of grew big enough to where it like perforated a little bit of my lower intestine or something. And it basically created the abscess, and then, you know, it turned septic. So it's kind of,
it was like really sudden, like it like I'm trying to process like what that might feel like mentally, like, because you have all these people coming at you, different doctors, they're not really keeping you in the loop, but then again, you said you were medicated, so like that is something as well to consider. I'm just trying to imagine, like, that must cause a lot of panic.
Truly, and I've always been a person that's been absolutely terrified of medical stuff. Like, I mean, I had gone, you know, I barely went to the doctor in my 20s because you kind of don't even really have to unless you have like a chronic condition, right? But then in my 30s, and especially my later 30s as I was going to my 40s, it was that kind of thing where like I begrudgingly would have to go get checkups, and I hated it, and it was always like a nightmare, and I always had like white coat hypertension. It was just like stressful. So anything that's medical was always really stressful for me. And it wasn't until like this happened, which was like the first time like I said I'd ever been to the hospital. And like, I mean, it was just that thing where I just kind of like let it happen and was like, let me just take things like one step at a time. Like, you're going to tell me this information, it may not be complete, but at least it's going to kind of connect the dots about what's going to happen to me next. It's just weird. And I guess that's why they do it like that, because maybe it's because they are like, if we give you the entire scope of things right now, it's just too much for you. And, you know, maybe if we just kind of explain to you what's going to happen next, then it kind of at least lets you break it down and kind of understand it on a, you know, Yeah. But it was,
you're prepared.
It was still like really hardcore, like to the point where I was just like, okay, like,
yeah.
When you're in it, you know, you're kind of just like, all right, I'm just going to do whatever they tell me to do because I really don't have a choice. But then, like, it wasn't until really like the third or fourth day in the hospital when I really began to like start processing what was going on. And then it became like a, oh shit, like, mm-hmm. how is this going to affect the rest of my life? Like, am I ever going to get out of here? Like, yeah, it became like a whole other thing. So.
Yeah. Totally. I feel like also as wow. a person, I do have chronic illness. I have endometriosis. And oh, yes. I have like sporadic pain that happens out of nowhere. And then there's the aspect of that being frustrating because throughout my life, doctors and family who are now kind, but it took a lot of like understanding over a long period of time. So it's like I have a lot of disassociation right. that I think comes when I feel pain. Like I think that there's a part of it where you have to remove yourself from your body in some sort of way yep. in order just to process the amount of pain that you're in. So I'm curious if you experienced that on some level.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a part of me that felt like it was happening like in another dimension or something. Like it wasn't like, because again, like you have, I think I'd always had this identity of like, you know, oh, I don't want to get sick or I don't get sick. And, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, at the time I was, you know, I exercised quite frequently. Yeah. I mean, in fact, I was at Barry's boot camp the week before I went into hospital. I was like, you know, really, you know, doing a lot of good things for my body. So of course I'm sitting here thinking like, how is this even possible? And, you know, and so there was a part of me that was like, what's yeah. going on? Like, I don't really know. Like in order for me to process it, it had to become like some story or something. I don't know. It was very strange, but and being in pain like that, I mean, I really do feel like it was so kind of, I can think about people who have that all the time and feel, you know, as really terrible. Like, I mean, you know, now that I've experienced that kind of pain, I'm like very aware of how other people have it and they have it more frequently than others. And so, you know, and endometriosis I hear is awful. Like I have a couple friends that have it and, you know, it's totally life altering for some of them. You know.
Yeah, I have had friends yeah. that have had to have multiple surgeries, and I think the worst part for one of my friends is like yeah. she's a Virgo, she's a workaholic, so it makes her feel like when she's incapacitated and she has to take time off from work, number one, she feels bad because she wants to be the breadwinner, right. and it makes her feel weak, like she's not doing her part. Where she's not doing enough. And then on top of that, like you get the chatter in your ear when it comes to like, unfortunately, a lot of reproductive disorders where it's like people think you're faking it or people think you're sucking it up for so much attention or like, yep. it's like, oh my God, it's a period, get over it. And they don't understand the fact that like, you know, there's drugs that you have to take for endometriosis, like such as Lupron, which are, you know, actually chemotherapy drugs. And so you have a lot of, I mean, it is used for prostate cancer. And so literally what men are using for prostate cancer, women are using to treat their endometriosis. It's a chemotherapy drug, but we don't have like the luxury of getting time off from work as easy
Absolutely.
As someone who
and
says I
have it's
cancer.
All obviously
you know
like
I mean?
A patriarchal, so it, you know, okay. thing. Where you're sitting there having like, cause they obviously don't get anything that relates to our bodies and they're always trying to regulate our bodies anyway. So, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's like anything that deals with yeah. like, you know, women's bodies, like it's almost like, you know, it's a blind spot for so many people, especially men. And so, yeah, there's, of course there'll be like, you know, people who think you're making it up, or it's just, you know, you're just being hysterical, and, you know, sort of, you know, it's just all of those opinions, which really, I mean, and now, even in my experience now with having now a sort of a chronic, you know, medical issue that I have to take care of, like, there's so much that's so loaded, and it's so, like, you never know when you're allowed to talk about it and if you are allowed to keep making it this excuse, because so many people are just uncomfortable, you know.
I have a confession. I'm kind of obsessed with vintage lingerie, and I have been pretty much my whole life. Which sounds kind of weird to say, but I also grew up obsessed with Courtney Love, and her style was so informative to my own personal style since I was a child. I love slips, I love teddies, I love taking the pinup girl style and making it my own. And when I'm looking for good vintage lingerie, Bride of the Fox has my back. They are a store located in Roanoke, Virginia, but they have an online presence, so you can shop online too. And you can find them on Instagram at Bride of the Fox. They have great items all the way from 1915 to the 1990s. Right now I'm kind of obsessed with this teddy that they have. It's like kind of beige and beautiful and silk, but what I really love is that it has a 40-inch bust, and it's so hard to find lingerie that's like good for someone who's kind of top heavy like me. So if you're also into vintage lingerie, you should go right now, add Bride of the Fox on Instagram, and you can check out their Etsy store. Some of their stuff is also on Instagram. And if you do live in Virginia, go to their in-person store. They even have private appointments.
I wanted to hear about your recovery process. I'd love to talk about how that affected you on a mental level, and then obviously the physical level as well. How long were you, I mean, you were out of the hospital within 2 weeks, but I'm sure there was a lot of time in bed. And what did that look like for you?
Yeah. So I'll tell you, like, you know, like I said, a couple days after I was in the hospital, where I was just kind of sitting in there and finally like thinking, oh, okay. Like, I just had like a major thing happen to me. And now I'm kind of like in this mode where, you know, the immediate drama of it has passed. And now I'm just recovering. And so there was this moment of like, I don't know how long I'm going to be in this hospital. And so I started becoming very like freaked out by that. And you know, I was having doctors, like, once I got out of ICU, like, ICU was awful. It's like a nightmare from like a heavy metal video in the 80s. It's terrible. And then you go into your room, and then you're sort of there, you know, you have, you know, my family was coming in, my friends were coming in. And then, you know, like, all of a sudden, I'm sitting here going like, okay, this could take forever. I don't really know how long when I'm going to go home. And a lot of that was because I also had a little, like, I had a tiny piece of my small intestines removed, because in the surgery, I guess they figured out that, you know, I had so much bacteria in my abdomen that I had to take out a piece of my small intestine. So yeah, which was intense. And so basically I wasn't eating or drinking. I was, you know, being fed with an IV.
Yeah.
And, so there was this moment of like, I sat there and said, oh my God, I haven't had any food or any water in a week. And it really, like, I flipped out basically. And so it became this thing where I was like, I just have to get out of the hospital. Like, I have to do whatever I can to, you know, get out of here and to like eat real food. And, you know, I just wasn't, you know, it wasn't clear to me when the end of it was going to be. And so, you know, I was extremely motivated to get out. So, you know, I did whatever they told me to do. Like, they tell you to get up and walk around. And I was doing all that as much as possible. You know, I was using like the breathe, you know, how sometimes you have to blow into the breathing thing to like make the balls go up. It's like a thing that happens, I guess, when you have surgery, so you don't get pneumonia. They make you breathe in that thing. And so I was doing all that. I was like basically trying to be like the best hospitals person in the world. I was like, all right, I'm going to get the fuck out of here. And so eventually I got out and it was great. I mean, I felt so amazing getting out and just like breathing fresh air and sort of feeling like I was a part of the world again. But I was obviously like very weak and I could barely walk. I mean, I had an open wound. I had basically what they call an exploratory laparotomy, which is essentially when they cut you right down the middle.
Wow.
And so I had this huge, you know, wound that was being essentially closed together by a, they call it a wound vacuum. So I guess it's this like new technology where instead of, you know, just putting the big fancy, you know, the big Frankenstein stitches the way they used to, they take this machine and it has like a sponge on top and it's kind of sucking the wound closed.
Is that the little thing that you posted online? There was like a picture of something. It looked like a pocket. You made a pocketbook out of it.
Yeah. They give me this like, so it looks like, it kind of, it's about the size of like a mini iPad or something. It's kind of this like, but it's big. It's like this big little robot that has a tube that goes directly to your wound. And essentially it's just like this little, and they try to give you this like pocket, like this almost like a, you could wear it a bunch of different ways. You could wear it as a purse. You could wear it as a fanny pack if you really wanted to, but it was just like so dumb. I mean, it was just like such a dumb thing.
It's good that you can laugh at it though. I feel like that's healthy.
Oh yeah. I mean, listen, like when it came down to it, I was like, this is all new information for me. I really don't know what the fuck is going on. I just have to laugh about some of this because it's like part of the way that I guess a lot of people process trauma is that just they like look at sort of the irony or the ridiculousness of things and you're just like, I don't know what else to do. Like, I just have to laugh because I mean, I'm wearing this like dumb thing and, you know, and I'm really lucky. Again, I like have to say that I feel very fortunate that I, you know, like when I, this is the worst thing that has ever happened to me. And I, this
but
is
a, insurance and like all of those things.
Yes. That I was like, I was lucky to have health insurance. I was extremely lucky because I live in California and my family lives, you know, on the East Coast. And so they actually came out here like literally 12 hours, like 12 hours after it happened, both my mom and dad. And they stayed at my house. Like while I was in the hospital, they came and they were in my apartment. They were like doing my laundry because it was literally like I left. Like, I mean, when I went to the hospital, it's like my dog was in the living room with the TV on. And like, you know, it was just like a, I fucking left. Like I just had to go. So they came and they really helped me get my everything organized for when I got out of the hospital. And then my dad actually stayed in my apartment with me for 6 weeks after I got out of the hospital. And I mean, it was incredible. Like, I mean, I could get really emotional talking about it because I, you know, he was doing my laundry and like taking the dog out and doing all these things that you just never think. You think, oh, like I'm going to get out of the hospital. I'm totally fine. But it was like, the reality was I could barely walk and I couldn't pick up anything. I couldn't like, you know, I was having a nurse come to the apartment she came 3 times a week because they have to change the dressing of the wound, you know, 3 times a week. So I was having this like health nurse come over. So I had this like, it was like an active situation. And so, you know, he was doing everything, like washing dishes. I mean, I really couldn't, I'm just incredibly grateful that I had that infrastructure. But, you know, it was, so basically what happened is that I got out of the hospital. I was living in a one bedroom apartment with my father. and I wasn't at work and I just had a lot of time to start thinking about things. And you know, at the same time, I was going to so many doctor's appointments because at the time that I got out of the hospital, remember I said, like, they don't give you all the information you need, right? So at that point, we were, you know, I was unsure about the tumor thing because I was basically like, okay, I know that I have this thing. It caused this horrible thing to happen. But, you know,
were they able to remove the tumor or was the tumor still there?
The tumor is still there because when they figured out what it was, because there was a period of time where they weren't sure if it was like benign or not. And there was, you know, oncologists were involved and it was very like, kind of like, okay, I don't know what this is. But part of what happened is that because it's in such a weird location, to like completely remove it would probably just be more trouble than it's worth because it's just kind of in this weird spot. And, you know, chances are it's probably just going to, like, grow back or something. So the only thing they can do is, at this point, it's being monitored because they just don't want it to get big enough to where it, like, punctures organs again. So it's like, I have, at this point, I go every 4 months to get an MRI and just check things out because, you know, it's, but it's best case scenario for me in terms of I don't have to treat it. We haven't treated it yet, which is great because the treatment options are, you know, anything from like, and the oncologist has told me that it's actually great that I have a lot of different ways to treat it because, you know, it gives me a lot of options. But if it gets bad enough,
it makes you feel more in control as well, which is great in a situation where you feel no control with your body.
Well, right. And that's, I mean, it's just, it was just such a lot of information and a lot of like different things that were happening. And so it was like, because that's a big thing for me, I think, when I got out and started really, really thinking about it. And I was like, okay, like, I don't know what happened. Like, I don't know. And I, of course, my instinct was to blame myself in a weird way. Like, I was like, oh, I did this, right? Like, I caused this to happen because I, you know, have, you know, you think about it in terms of like risk factors and like histories and stuff like that. And I was like racking my brain to be like, well, of course I did it because I don't know, I used to drink a lot or I drank the week before or like, you know, or like I used to be a smoker or like, you know, I was coming up with all these different ideas. And it was the hardest thing was having doctors be like, yeah, we literally have no idea how you got this. It could have been there forever. It could have just been there for a short period of time. I mean, you know, we don't know. It just happens. And so I was like, the uncertainty of that was very hard. It still is hard. it was kind of like existential in a weird way where I was kind of going like, why do things happen like this to people who are good? And like, you know, I just was kind of like going through it in a really big way. And I still struggle with it, honestly. I mean, I have had like a big, you know, obviously we're talking about trauma and I did not expect to have had, like, I just didn't expect to have any sort of like trauma or PTSD or even kind of like thoughts about it. Like, I just thought it was a thing where it's like something bad happened. It happened. It's over. Thank God. Now I just like live the rest of my life. But it's so not like that. It's so, it's so much more complicated. So
I had a friend that had a heart attack in his 30s. And it was because, I think it was because he had like a heart defect that they never caught.
Right.
And he had to have a pacemaker put in him and he was on the table and he died, but he came back. And
oh my God.
For a few seconds he had died. And he still has obviously heart problems. He walks around and, you know, he's doing fine. He's still smoking weed.
Yeah.
But like, he kind of feels like he has to because he has so much anxiety
and PTSD from the fact that he almost died, and that it could happen again, because again, they just didn't know what exactly happened because they didn't catch it soon enough. Right. And I think a lot of people, again, like when situations like that happen, it's like, we don't have great health insurance. So it's like, we're not on top of our health the way that, and diligent the way that we should be sometimes. Not everybody, but like a lot of people, I mean, a lot of my friends, at least, like, they don't really have opportunities to get just checked up all the time because they don't have the best health insurance, you know?
Well, right. And like, and the thing about it too, though, is that like, you can be healthy, a healthy person, even, you know, have that stamp of approval from doctors every year, and shit can still happen. I mean, literally, like, that's the weirdest part about all of this. And the part that it's almost like, you know, we obviously talk about this kind of, you know, like an urban legend kind of way, where you're like, oh yeah, like totally healthy Olympic athlete just died, or like has cancer or something, and you're like, yeah, I mean, that's obviously like something we just tell ourselves as in like, isn't that crazy? But like, it actually does happen sometimes. So it's, you know,
My sister-in-law had lung cancer. She is in remission, like I think 2 or 3 years now. She's never smoked a cigarette.
That's like, right.
It's and she's not like older. Like, she was in her 40s and she had just given birth like 2 years prior. It just completely happened out of nowhere. And those things definitely happen, and that's really scary. And to live with that every day has to be anxiety ridden. So I'm curious, like, okay, so two questions. Number one, how do you think you deal with that in a healthy way on the day to day? And then I'm curious, like, I'm thinking about like the being in a one bedroom apartment with your dad, and just, it is a very like solitary time, even if your dad is with you. So what were some of the things that you were able to do to not be anxious, to keep sane, to maybe even take that time to like self-explore? Or how did you kind of turn what was a trauma into like kind of a triumph in some way? Because I feel like you're kicking it, you're doing things, you're working again, you seem pretty happy, pretty grateful. So it has, despite all the anxiety it's caused you, in some way made you have more pep in your step, I feel like.
Well, yeah. And I, you know, it was not easy. It continues to not be easy, because I will say that I am also lucky that I never had suffered from depression, or, you know, I'd had some moments of mild anxiety and maybe some even mild depression, but I was never diagnosed with depression or an anxiety problem in the past. So, you know, having said that, this whole experience, this entire year really has been about, you know, discovering that part of myself that is now like, you know, I potentially have, you know, a PTSD that involves depression and anxiety. Because the weirdest part about it is that when I went, okay, so what, I'll back up and I'll kind of like answer your second question first, the second question and then the first. So, you know, when I was in the hospital, like they have usually in most hospitals, they have like a chaplain, a non-denominational, a lot of times chaplain that will come to each person and just kind of check in with them to be like, what's up? I'm not a very religious person. I grew up Catholic, but I have not really contemplated like religion. I mean, I think I was like more spiritual than religious, but you know, this guy came to my room and he was like, he just basically told me like, I'm a non-denominational religious person who is coming to talk to you if you need my help. And at first I was kind of like, what? And then I literally sat and talked to him for like an hour. Yeah. And just basically like spilled everything about how I was feeling. I just thought how disoriented I felt. I didn't know why this was happening to me. I'm like, you know, really sad about it because I just feel so defeated by this thing. And I just was like, and I'm scared and I'm like nervous about how, you know, what's going to happen to me. And he was very chill and very, you know, he had kind of this like surfer wisdom, which I really appreciated. He was kind of like hippie guy, which is very LA, I think. But like, you know, he had kind of these like prayer beads and he had like long blonde kind of surfer hair. And so I think he was kind of giving me a little bit of that, a little bit of that like hippie surfer wisdom.
I'm imagining this being your pilot, like, yeah. Episode one.
Yeah. It wasn't like, I mean, yeah, it was not, it was less like, you know, Catholic priest and definitely more like, you know, LA like hippie guy. And I was like, this is great, actually. So I had had that moment with him, and it really was the first time that I was really kind of thinking about it on like, you know, a bigger level. And so when I got out of the hospital, I was with my dad. I was watching a lot of TV, like a lot of TV.
What were you watching?
Primarily Bravo television. So I was watching like Vanderpump Rules, which of course, you know, is like one of my favorite reality shows.
Oh my goodness. I had something that happened to me that caused me a lot of PTSD a few years ago. And I remember specifically, I've said this on this audio zine before, like I watched Vanderpump Rules for hours, and that's what helped me cope through this really traumatic thing that happened to me.
Yeah. And I, you know, it's funny because I have a friend right now that's just, she just has given birth to her second child, and she's kind of, you know, going through some postpartum stuff. Mm-hmm. And she's binge watching Vanderpump Rules. And I was like, I've been there. Like I've been on the couch watching like all the seasons in a row. And I watched a lot of that and a lot of Below Deck for some reason, because I guess that was on a lot.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of Bravo reality. My dad and I together watched like a Ken Burns documentary about the West, which was like,
ooh, watch that. That's good.
Yeah, it was great. Right. Like it was something that my dad and I like were able to watch together, which I really enjoyed because I didn't want him to like feel bored or something. I don't know. I just was sort of like,
he's not about the pasta.
Yeah, he's not. No, I was like, don't watch this trash. Let's watch something like educational. But you know, a lot of it was just kind of like being stir crazy. And I was also just feeling, I can't tell you, like I felt, it was so weird. It was like, I felt like a baby and an old person at the same time. Like that's
in there. I know that feeling.
Yeah. But where I was like, here I am getting, you know, taken care of by my father. I haven't lived with my father since I was like 17 years old or 18 years old. And then he's like literally taking care of me. And I also feel like an old person because I'm just wearing like robes and slippers and I'm like shuffling around the house and I'm just like, oh, it fucked with me so bad. Like, you know, and I just started to feel like really weird about my, you know, I was looking pretty gaunt. I mean, I just was like, you know, I had lost a lot of weight because I just was not eating, you know, a lot when I first got out. And then, you know, just sleeping all the time, taking a lot of medication. So it was like, it just really made me feel crazy. And, you know, obviously that process got better as I was getting stronger. I mean, I was really, again, really motivated to get over it. Like, I think that's maybe like one of my, I will say that was probably like one of my strong suits about me and my personality is that I'm not the type of person that just wants to sit around and like bathe in sadness in a weird way. Like I just am like, oh my God, I can't sit here and think about how shitty this is. I have to like get over it. So let's, you know, I was always like
your forward movement.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm an Aries. So I was like, let's go. Like, I want to get back out there. Like I was trying to get my dad to go on walks with me. And, you know, every time it was like a little bit further every time. And it was just like, I was cleaning the house, which my mom was like screaming at me. She was just like, you can't you can't mop right now. You've got an open wound. And I'm like, I want to. I'm so bored. I just want to clean. And she's just like, let your dad do that. Like, don't injure yourself. But I just wanted to, you know what I mean? Like, I just wanted to be active.
I get that.
Yeah.
But I think I went like that when I was dealing with a lot of grief stuff. You just want normalcy. You want your old routine back so bad. You're like willing to fight for it.
Oh, absolutely. And I remember when I was going to the surgery office, because, you know, they want you to have follow-up visits to make sure your wound is healing and that everything's fine. And I just remember I asked one of the doctors, I was like, do you know when I can go back to spin class? Because I was like, I love spin. And it's just like, I love being on a bicycle, really, more than actual spin class. But I just like love, I was doing it like 3 times a week before I went to the hospital. And he was just like, are you kidding me? Like, you almost died. So like, calm down, girl. Like,
yeah,
it's only been like 3 weeks and you're asking me like, when can I go back to SoulCycle? I'm like, dude, he's like, he was literally laughing in my face, which I was like, okay, I probably just
literally the hardest exercise you could possibly do.
I know.
When can I go and maybe do a yoga class or something?
Oh yeah. No, I was like, when are we going back to, like, you know, boot camp? And he's just like, you're insane. But, you know, I figured it out eventually. I was like, oh, yeah, I can't even, like, walk down the block. I got to take one thing at a time. But it was – I think the big thing for me was that I was lucky that I had lots of people who cared about me, because that was the big fear, right? That's a big fear, I think, of a lot of people, especially women, single women, I will say. You know, a lot of it is that, like, oh, I'm going to fall down in my house and no one's going to know and no one's going to care. Like, you know, I'm so far away from a lot of my friends and family. But I got to tell you, like, it was such a surprise to know that when something like that happens to me, like, I was very lucky that I had my family who were immediately there, my coworkers, my friends, like, everyone was like sending me things and checking in and like offering to, like, you know, organize food and like all this stuff. I mean, it was like the outpouring of support that I got was, again, like, I can get emotional thinking about it, but I'm just like, I never thought that that would happen. And I'm very fortunate for that, but it was, so yeah, I mean, the physical part was definitely like a process to like get mm-hmm. back, you know, get things back. I think emotionally it's been a lot tougher because, like I said, I was processing all of this information and feeling very sad, because it is sad. Like, being sick makes you feel sad because for whatever reason, like, you know, you just think, why is this happening to me? Or like, I have to, like, you know, I don't get a lot of, there's sort of just, you know, when you think about it, you're like, oh, is this going to hurt or hinder the way that I like to live my life? And so there's sadness. And so I was, and just also beyond the reasons of like, why did this happen? But like, now, how is this going to affect me? And am I going to be a sick person? It was really tough. And I will say this for people who have medical trauma,
mm-hmm.
there isn't a lot for us. There isn't a lot out there to help us, because it really, I think, is more all the PTSD help that was researching was really primarily for veterans and for sexual abuse victims. There wasn't a lot of medical PTSD. You know, there's definitely not like an organization. There wasn't even a lot of hits. Like, when I would just Google it, like, there's not a lot.
And you would think that there were, because that affects so many people. Like, and if not, there's like a support group for people who are going through that and want to support someone that they care about, you know? Like,
absolutely.
How can I be a good friend and help with my wife's anxiety after her? You mean there should be support groups for things like that, you know?
Absolutely. And I was desperate. I will say this. I was desperate to find somebody or something that would like validate what I was feeling, because I was feeling super, like I said, I had and still have like a depression from this and anxiety from this, and especially anxiety, like the hypervigilance that happens after you've gone through a major medical event is like,
it's a lot.
I mean, it is crippling, where like everything sets off all the alarms. Like just even, I mean, to this day, I find myself, I have these like adaptive behaviors where I check my temperature a lot. Every time I feel like sort of weird, I get a little nervous about it. I mean, it was a lot worse, I'll tell you. Like, it was a lot worse. It's gotten better.
Have you tried doing body scans, like, in a journal every day, just to kind of touch base with yourself a little bit? Are you aware what body scans are?
No.
Okay. So there's two different forms of body scans. So there's a body scan meditation you can do where you kind of slowly wiggle your feet and your toes and you slowly just kind of bring to life and touch and feel and sense every part of your body, just to kind of as a grounding exercise to get back into your body. Mm-hmm. But there's these things also called body scans, which is like you draw kind of like almost like a chalk outline of a body, and you kind of write down every day, or in the morning or in the night before you go to bed, whatever you feel comfortable with, you kind of write down how they're feeling, maybe what you've eaten that day. And so you can really bring it to your doctor, first of all, and like notice patterns, and they can kind of see, well, you know, maybe you have headaches because I noticed that you're eating A, B, and C, or maybe I noticed that you have, you know, pain maybe 2 weeks before your period. Right. So that's the pattern. So it's kind of like, you're doing your own statistics on your body, so it gives you a sense of control. And it's also like really grounding if you have medical trauma. Mm-hmm. So I would recommend doing that. Like, get a little journal, unless you feel like it would make you too neurotic.
No, that's such a great idea. And
then you have it also for your doctor. So like the doctor will actually like listen to you, because you're actually taking note, and it actually like helps them kind of use the best of their time, because they're probably seeing a ton of patients, you know? Yeah. So if you have something to physically give them, they can kind of look at it more analytical.
Yeah, that's such a great idea. I mean, to be completely honest with you, like I was and am desperate for any type of way to help manage the PTSD, because like I said, when I first got out, I just was sort of like, you know, trying to figure out what this was and what I was feeling. I know that I was experiencing, you know, huge anxiety, huge depression, and I didn't know what to do with it, because I just kept thinking like, should I be over this? Like, why do I still feel rotten? Like, I should be lucky to be alive. I should be lucky to be all these things, but I just feel like shit, and I don't know what this could be. And again, with PTSD, I think the common, like the conventional wisdom of it is that it doesn't exist for anybody but people who have been in war and people who've experienced like horrible events, like, you know, mass shootings and stuff. And so when you just tell people, oh, I have PTSD because I had this emergency surgery, they're kind of like, okay, is that real? So I was very like willing to try everything, which I think is also part of my personality that I think is good for this situation, is that I was, like I said, like I'm very extremely motivated to feel better. And so I was like, I'll try anything. So I was going online a lot, not finding particular like things that were specific to my situation. I had gone on Reddit actually a few times. Like, there's a PTSD Reddit, and it's very much like it's all over the board in terms of people's trauma. And so I connected with a few people on there for a while, which was actually really helpful, that were medical PTSD, like a woman who had like a really awful pregnancy and had a very traumatic birth. And so she and I kind of exchanged a few emails. And then what really helped was that I actually did find a therapist in Los Angeles that was focused on body trauma, which I think is so amazing. Like I couldn't believe my luck in a weird way.
Yeah.
And he happened to be in my neighborhood and he was under my insurance. I mean, I was like, this is insane. His method, he's very trained in like, it's called like neuroaffective touch. And so a lot of it is body work where you kind of go to the office, you do a little bit of talk therapy, but then you can get on his table and he does a lot of like, it's basically the idea that like touch is therapy. Like,
oh, it totally is.
Yeah. And it's, I've never heard of it until I went there and it's really amazing. Like he uses a lot of like different types of props, like blankets and heated pillows. And, you know, we do sort of like a body scan in the sense that we're just kind of going through parts of the body and making sure that we're like checking in with everything. And, you know, if there are places in my body that feel just weird or, you know, whatever, just don't feel good, we kind of try to see what that's about. And it's been amazing. I've been seeing him for this past year and he's helped a lot. But I think that was the thing that I think is the tool that I think I needed was that I just need, I wanted to be, I was willing to try anything. Yeah. And that's hard for people because it does feel like you don't know what's going on and you don't, no one's telling you, you have to do your own research, which is hard. It is very hard, but I was like, all right, I'm going to go try this body trauma therapist. I was doing and still do a lot of meditation, a lot of restorative yoga, which has been very helpful for me. And like your idea of doing journaling, all that stuff is like ultimately really helpful because like you said, like if there isn't a system in place to help you, if there's not like a place to go every week, there's not like a 12 step or some sort of, you know, counseling center for medical PTSD, then, you know, you're kind of like on your own and it that can feel terrible. So
I think that's why I love alternative healing communities and things like Reiki or like even people who do ASMR videos, because I feel like there is an underrepresented group of people, not just with medical trauma, but all different types of trauma with their bodies that we don't think about. Like having an experience being in the wrong gender, for instance, is a form of trauma. Being on the autism spectrum and not really understanding how your sensory issues work compared to everyone else's. Why are you bothered by things that other people are not bothered about but are so simple, like going to the movie theater? Like that is a form of trauma.
Absolutely.
So things like going to a body worker and it are really great. And like, even if you, I want to say this, if anyone's listening and they don't have insurance, little things that you can do, get a weighted blanket. Weighted blankets are amazing, and they are especially great with people who have sensory issues or people who have anxiety. Like, it will change your life. ASMR is another thing that I love because tapping in particular can be very calming to the neural pathways, you know? Like, so there are tools out there. We wish that there were more. Please create them. But I think a lot of times we have to go to these alternative spaces to feel represented.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the biggest message for me was when I got out of the hospital, and this is no disrespect to the hospital that I went to, because quite frankly, they saved my life and I'm thankful for them. But
yeah,
you know, after I got out of the hospital, I was, like I said, desperate for any kind of help for what I was experiencing. And I remember calling the chaplain. Like I was like, let me, maybe he does, you know, sort of aftercare or outpatient, you know, counseling, or maybe he can point me to the direction of a place that would be able to do that for me. And I just remember calling up the, you know, whatever it is, the religious services or the chaplain at the hospital. And I just explained to them, like, I just got out of the hospital. I think I'm going to be needing some more sort of like spiritual guidance or something. And they were just kind of like, yeah, sorry, we don't do that. We're not, you know, like we do it for the patients that are in the hospital, but in terms of now that you're out, you're on your own, baby. I'm like, fuck. Like,
yeah,
you know? And so, yeah, it becomes a moment where you're like, okay, well, you know, traditional medicine, traditional doctors aren't doing this for me, and I've got to go find it on my own. And, you know, like I said, I'm like, again, I keep going back to being very fortunate because I really do feel that. I'm fortunate to live in a place that is very open and has a lot of that infrastructure. Like in this community, there's a lot of like alternative medicine, a lot of like counseling, very specific counseling, and a lot of spirituality. So, you know, versus living in maybe the town I grew up in the South, which is not...
Yeah.
Not the place. So I'm lucky that I was even able to find therapy for what I needed. But you're right. Sometimes it is going online, using free, you know, I know that there are some places that are free. Like I went to Reddit. I mean, Reddit is absolutely just like a free thing, you know, yeah. And I was trying it all. So yeah, not having insurance, sometimes, you know, you can find ways around that. So
yeah, well, thank you so much for sharing your story. I feel like someone is gonna listen to this and really connect with it, and like, let's have a discussion about medical trauma, or if you have had medical trauma, maybe reach out to Millie and maybe we can create a space where you can talk about it that's not Reddit. Not that there's anything wrong with Reddit,
but... Yeah, well, I will say, like, I've always told myself that I should, because there wasn't a place that I felt like for me, that I would create that space. So even if it is down to like messaging me on a social media platform, I'm so willing to talk to anybody that's had it. And, you know, I would love to eventually at one point, like, sort of, you know, either find a space or make a space that's a little bit more like, you know, like do a website or a nonprofit or something like that. Yeah. I know that the research on it is new. Like I've been reading certain really new like medical papers and medical journal kind of opinions and articles about medical PTSD, especially with like ICU stays. And, you know, I think it's a growing concern, but I think there's people coming around to it. So maybe in the future there will be more, I'm hoping, but you know, for now too, I'm willing to share my experience with anyone and talk to anybody. So
have you ever thought about doing a podcast since okay. So I love Millie's podcast. Is it RIP? Is it happening again? Is Sorted Details ever coming back?
I will never say never, but you know, it's really tough because April and I, you know, she lives on the pretty much like on the opposite schedule. I mean, she lives in England, so yeah. She's eight hours away. So it's been really tough to get together, but you never know. That's all I'll say. So
yeah. Well, I hope so, but maybe you should do a podcast on medical trauma or PTSD in general, like in giving a voice to people who might feel like their voices aren't heard in that community. That might be interesting at some point, or like interviewing doctors about it or alternative therapists.
Yeah, I would love that. I mean, I at this point, I love the idea of podcasting because I think it is a good way to sort of like, it's like a place for people to come to. And like I said, like being that this information right now is so fractured in this Google, like in a Google search, and there's like really kind of no center for it. Maybe that is the way to do it, is do a podcast. I need to think about that because I would actually love to do that.
There you go. I feel like that's natural for you. You have a wonderful speaking voice. You have podcasting experience. If anybody's listening to this, the first time I ever heard Millie on a podcast was April's podcast when you did Go Bayside.
All right.
It was a brilliant episode about Screech's spaghetti sauce.
Yeah, I get a lot of feedback about that because it is just as an episode of television in general, it's just such a ridiculous premise. But I think that, like, April and I have known each other since we were 14 years old, and I think that that is sort of the thing that I think people connect to, is just knowing somebody for a long time and having kind of a natural rapport with them. And so being able to just like sit around and talk about that particular episode was super fun, but also I think other people really loved it, and I'm happy that they loved it. So
amazing. I feel like the reason I was able to fall in love with Sordid Details, or go by side for that matter, is because I think a lot of people go to podcasts because they feel, even if they don't feel lonely all the time, there is a sense of like, as we get older and we don't get to talk to our friends as much, and we don't get to have those goofy conversations that we did at the lunch table as much. And so people go to podcasts because there's a sense of intimacy, and it's like, usually you're listening to it at work with your headphones in or at the gym, and it's just like people's few minutes of like themselves every day. And so to hear like something as silly as Screech's spaghetti sauce, really personally, in a tough time in my life where I was going through PTSD, full circle, I feel like you guys kind of made me feel like you were the lunch table I wished that I could have sat at in high school. I would totally hang out with you guys. You were a year older than me, but like, I liked Morrissey and and all that stuff and all the things you guys talked about. So you guys kind of healed me a little bit.
Oh, that's so wonderful to hear. I mean, like, honestly, like when we were doing it, we were like, I mean, even with Sordid Details, we were like, this is the dumbest shit ever. But like, it really did like weirdly make, like, it made people feel, I guess maybe because it was sort of just conversational and random, and it wasn't this like big produced, you know, thing, that it made people feel like we were just hanging out. And I had a lot of my friends back home that were like, oh, I listen to your podcast because it was like hanging out with you every day or every week, and it wasn't like, you know, it was like talking to you on the phone. And I'm like, oh, I love that, because I definitely believe in the warmth of radio and podcasting. And I used to work in radio, like before I started working in TV, and so I was on the radio every week, and I just, it is such a intimate medium. And especially now when you, as you get older, but also in this world where, you know, we're just like not as, you know, connected, right? So you're,
we're
like
connected, but we're not.
Yeah. Well, maybe, you know, like you're just not, you're just busy and you're online, but you're not really like interacting in like a more intimate way. And so I think that's what podcasting does, is it brings people closer. So
absolutely. I feel like I started doing this as, I mean, technically it is a podcast, but I kind of like liked the idea of it sounding more like an audio zine, because I grew up loving zines, making zines. And like, you remember the old punk rock cassettes you would get, and they would always have like a movie riff or something right
before the
song. And I was like, I want to bring that to podcasting. I want it to feel like I'm literally taking my old like tape recorder and I'm making like a mixtape, the way I used to make mixtapes when I was 12 years old.
I love that.
To the microphone. And like, sometimes I want to add a 90210 clip. Sometimes I want to add a Saved by the Bell clip, and it's totally relevant to the conversation. It just makes it so much more cut and paste. And I hate, like you said, the production value. Like, the thing about Sordid Details is like, I mean, it does sound great, but there is just kind of a vibe of like sitting on the couch with your friend. And I kind of like that quality coming from punk. Like, I don't want like a crazy good jingle at the beginning. Like, I like that it's just like a David Bowie song, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, I came from zines too, and punk rock too, as you know. And like, you know, whenever I did zines, I was very much about like, I loved, you know, the cutting and pasting and scrapbooking kind of element of it. Like my zine was very much like a, I used to actually take copies of the Weekly World News, which is that like weird supermarket newspaper where it talks about like aliens and shit. Like, yeah, I used to like, I was obsessed with the Weekly World News, and I used to take like, you know, cut words out of it and pictures out of it and like tape them to my, paste them into my zine. And it would just be like, oh, here's a poem I wrote about this boy that I liked. And then here's like, you know, clips from the Weekly World News and from magazines and stuff. So it was like, I love that. That kind of raw DIY-ness to it. And I know April was that way too. And so when we were going to do this podcast together, we were just kind of like, yeah, let's just have it be whatever. Like if the neighbors start making noise and they start making noise and we're not going to edit it out, it's just what's going to happen. So
totally. There's like 10 car alarms in every episode because I live in the city. So
yeah,
I don't have a fancy editor, so guys, it's just the rawness of,
I love it,
doing a podcast or an audio zine. Okay, yeah. So now I want to ask you a little bit about your back to work. What are you working on?
So right now, you know, I work at on a cable channel. I work for Turner Classic Movies, which is the it's a classic film channel that's on cable. You probably get it, or your parents or your grandparents probably watch it. And so I do a show, a little, we call it a franchise, but it's basically like a weekly showcase of cult films that comes on Friday nights. It's called TCM Underground. So I'm working on that. We're in the middle of our 13th season and it's been going really well. I actually programmed 2 John Waters movies last week and have gotten a lot of feedback about it.
Oh my goodness. I think we discussed this, but Female Trouble, like I have a specific time and place memory of the first time I watched it. It's my favorite John Waters film. And yeah. I just cannot believe it was on television.
I know. I, at the time when I programmed it, was thinking, oh, this is, we're ready. Like America is ready to see Female Trouble because it's been so long. And like, but I got to tell you, like, we got a lot of, I mean, people loved it. But then I got a couple of emails from like really concerned older conservative people that were like, what is this monstrosity? So, and really, it's more a testament to John Waters as a filmmaker, the fact that he's still like shocking people after all this time, which is great. So I'm still working on that. And then I might be doing a new podcast in the future. It's going to be film related. So it'll be like, you know, related to what I do every day for work. So, you know, that's coming up. I don't know. I'm working at the details now, but, and then, you know, like I said, I mean, sort of details might come back for a couple of things. I know April has her own podcast now with her husband. So
what's your podcast called?
Oh, gosh, I can't remember what it's called because I don't think it's it's launched yet. But okay. I know that it's going to in the next couple of weeks. So
guys, Google April Richardson. She's really funny.
Yes, she is. She was professionally funny for so long. And like, I know she moved to England and now I think is maybe trying to do some more comedy, which I'm really pleased about because I was afraid she was going to quit forever. And I don't think that's the case, but we'll see. I'm happy.
Good. Well, thank you so much, Millie, for being so vulnerable and talking about this. And maybe once your podcast has launched, maybe we can have you back and we can have an update on how things have gone. And maybe by then you will have launched your own medical trauma podcast.
Yes, I am. Thank you so much for having me and for giving me the space to like talk about this kind of stuff. Because, you know, like I said, most of the time I go on podcasts, it's about film. And so it's really great that you have this podcast that's, you know, or audio zine that's really talking about this kind of thing with people, which is awesome. So thanks for that. But we'll see. Hopefully, you know, maybe in the next couple months I can start coming up with a plan to do this medical PTSD thing. So that would be great.
Well, let me know if you need any help or to connect you with anybody, because there's a lot of people in the Bird Black community that probably want to talk about their PTSD.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, have a great afternoon. Thank you so much.
Bye. Oh, you're welcome. Thanks. Bye.
Hi, I'm Christy. I'm an alcoholic and a Capricorn.
So today I wanted to share with you guys one of my favorite self-care tips and rituals that I do every day. So, I feel very connected to water. Water is very calming for me. I do have Neptune in my fourth house, so when I am near water, I find it almost a religious experience. It's very cleansing. So this is something that works for me. I don't know if it will work for you, but I'm sharing my process in hopes that it does. So every night I like to shower before I get into bed. I struggle with OCD, so getting into bed with my street clothes, not really an option for me. So in my nightly shower, I light a lot of candles and I turn off the light. I have just enough light so I can really see myself and not fall down, but I like it to be dark. I like it to close off some of my senses. Because I have sensory processing issues, it helps me to just focus on one of my senses at one time. So I use that with my feelings of touch, and sometimes with my feelings of smell. So I can light a candle that smells really good, calming. Common scents that I really like to use that I find calming are lavender, Palo Santo, and anything beach weather, like the smell of sand smells really good to me. So I have a lot of little beach candles. Peacefulness to me has always been the beach. So I like to integrate those smells into my experience. And so sometimes I'll even add essential oils to candles already. I also really like frankincense. Frankincense smells really good to me. It's very calming. And so I'll take my shower in the dark with a few candles. Sometimes I'll add a sound bath if I feel like adding another sensory element to it, but usually just two is fine for me. And throughout my shower, I just really visualize washing off the day, any bad energy. I like to visualize in my mind what that would feel like, grime all over my body. And I slowly just start the process of washing it off my body, and I notice the sensations. It helps ground me back into my body. When I put my loofah or my bar of soap all over my body, I find it really calming. And I massage the shampoo and conditioner into my head. And when I'm doing that, I sort of imagine my brain just kind of getting moved around. So I'm like physically shuffling the thoughts in my brain, letting them relax, letting them just move around, pushing other thoughts forward. And the physical touch of that and the visualization of that really helps me settle down before bed. And when I'm all done, I like to get cozied up in my bed. Maybe get a nice little CBD lollipop from my friends at Space Babes. And, you know, go to bed and relax. Clean, ready to start a brand new day. Washed all the grime off of me. And that's one of my self-care tips and rituals. It's very easy. And you can adapt it to your daily routine, just like I do. So I actually recorded the shower meditation yesterday, and tonight I was talking to my sister on the phone. She is 19 years older than me, and we've always been exceptionally connected, let's say. A lot of my a lot of the ways I perceive things intuitively, they're very much in alignment with my sister, and it's shared between us. It's almost like we share a brain sometimes. It's very weird. Genetics are weird, and unexplained reasonings for that. Totally weird. But I was recording the shower meditation yesterday, and I told her about it today. And she told me she does the exact same thing. She showers in the dark. We've never shared this with one another. And if anything, and you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you heard about my weird shower rituals I share because of my childhood with Sarah. So I think it's really funny learning the things that are genetic. Apparently, maybe my grandmother showered in the dark with a candle. Who knows? But it's a sweet thought, isn't it? And now time for 5-minute diagnosis.
Hello, my name is John Hanning. I was diagnosed with AIDS in 1995. My doctor told me I might have 6 months to live and that I needed to decide what I wanted to happen to my remains. In that moment, I said nothing. I just looked at her. But in my head, I heard two words. Fuck you. 6 months later, I returned home to Arkansas to die. The day after I got there, my folks asked me not to tell anyone why I had moved back. My stepdad and my little brother physically assaulted me a few weeks later. I called 1-800-555-1212, AT&T's toll-free directory assistance. An operator suggested I call the AIDS Resource Center in Dallas. So I did, and the next day, I drove down there, and I found an inexpensive apartment. I slept on the floor. I called my mom, and I asked her if she would help me get a mattress. She said no. A few days later, I read an article about HOPWA, Housing Assistance for People Living with AIDS, a federal program, and applied for rental assistance. A caseworker informed me that I was eligible, but that I might not receive the grant because the director of the Dallas office was a conservative and did not want the funds going to gay men living with AIDS, but to families with children with AIDS. After threatening to go to Lambda Legal, I received the funds to help me pay the rent. All of this was a total mindfuck, but I somehow managed to stay focused and got the help I needed. Survival instincts. If anyone out there living with HIV/AIDS is dealing with rejection, gossip, physical violence, or discrimination, first of all, hold your head up high and know that those who cast stigma are the ones with the problem, not you. Their stigma is about them. It's about their stupidity, their ignorance, their limited thinking. Lambda Legal, 1-866-542-8336. Call them and get the help that you need.
Sagittarius, are we compatible?
Yes, very.
Ooh. Okay,
are we compatible? I'm a Taurus.
Oh, no. No, we're actually mortal enemies. Wow. I love you, and sometimes the stars are wrong.
They're wrong.
Okay, I'm gonna get the one.
And now, Burn Black presents the Burn Black Book Club. Say that 5 times fast.
So this week I am reviewing the book Recovery by Russell Brand. And unless you've been living under a rock for the last 15 years, everyone knows who Russell Brand is. But in the case that you don't, Russell Brand is a writer, a podcaster, an actor, a comedian, a political commenter. He's done He's very avid in the transcendental meditation world. He kind of does it all. And he also is a recovered addict. And this addiction had started very much in childhood for him and has spiraled in many different ways, as many addicts experience. Because addiction is more a mode of thinking than necessarily the love or practicing one thing in a ritual. So we can be addicted to technology. We can be addicted to food. We can be addicted to alcohol. We can be addicted to narcotics. We can be addicted to love even, and sex. There's a million things that you could be addicted to, because it is all, you know, replacement behavior essentially. And that's a lot of what Russell really experienced when he began to write this book. He talks a lot about this. At first was an addiction to food, and then to smack, and then once he quit the smack, he got addicted to sex. It's all just, you know, these replacement behaviors. And so he writes a lot about his own experiences with fame and narcissism, and the narcissism that comes from addiction, and his own antidotes, I guess you would say, about those experiences and what he experienced in 12-step programs. And so he kind of rewrites the big book. It was time for an update. It's been, I don't know, a long time. And so this is just like a very good modern day updated version of the big book. And in case you are not a person that goes to rooms, the big book is the book that you get in Alcoholics Anonymous with the 12 steps. And so I would say, you know, this is a modern day 12-step program is all in this book, with anecdotes that make you laugh. I feel like a lot of people are really scared to go to 12-step meetings. The idea of being in a room and being vulnerable in front of all of these people is really scary. So this is like a really great place to start. And it covers a wide spectrum of addiction. So it's not just about alcohol and drugs, like I said. I mean, you can be addicted to love. We can be addicted to technology. We can be addicted to caffeine. And if you have any of these, you know, symptoms, then this is a great book to read. And in fact, I would recommend it to someone who does not have addiction issues as well, because it will help you understand the people in your life that do. And so I really fully laughed. I cried. I got a lot out of this book, honestly. I feel like all of his books have been quite excellent. They've never disappointed me, but this one in particular is very strong. He's a brilliant writer. So this week, I recommend this book. I recommend it for anybody who is looking at making some big choices this year and wants a little direction. They don't want someone talking down to them. They want something that they can relate to. This is the book for you.
And now for the self-care tip of the week.
Greetings and salutations. This is Lucy Fielding. I am a queer, non-binary femme. I'm a resident in counseling based in Charlottesville, Virginia, who specializes in sex therapy and gender therapy. I'm currently working on a book, Transsex: Clinical Approaches to Transsexualities and Erotic Embodiments, that should be out at the end of the year. And this is my self-care tip for the week for Burn Black. When we think of self-care, we often think of activities that take an hour or more, going to the gym, taking a long, luxurious bath, a hike or long walk in nature, a spa day, a longer lunch, or a cat nap. But what if you don't have an hour or half an hour? What if you have less than 15 minutes, less than 10 minutes, 5 minutes, 1 minute, or less than 5 seconds? This is where a self-care inventory can come in handy. A self-care inventory is a toolbox, as it were, because you may need different kinds of activities or rituals to be responsive to an array of different occasions or moments. When working with clients to develop their inventories, I encourage them to think of activities according to different chunks of time, beginning with 1 second and going up to a full day. Of course, because I'm a sexuality professional, solo sex or self-pleasuring, the ultimate self-care, will be a suggested part of that list. Because, as Oscar Wilde said, to love oneself is the beginning of a lifelong romance. But I thought I'd share 3 items on my inventory apart from solo sex. First thing in the morning, the moment I get to my office, I will often start the day with a 5-minute dance party. That really helps me set the tone for the day. Prince's Erotic City is a perennial favorite. If I only have 2 minutes, I'll often make recordings of myself reading a poem, usually something by a queer poet that's pretty erotic. Many of my relationships tend to be long distance, so these readings, these erotic ASMR recordings, help me bridge the distance and help me feel connected to a lover or partner, and they to me in turn. Finally, if I only have 1 or 2 seconds, as in the middle of a tough processing session, I will often lock eyes for a split second with one of the many objects I have in the spaces I inhabit. These objects are talismans and totems, imbued with rich personal histories and resonances for me. They help ground me, center me, and remind me of the fiery, fierce femme I am at my core. Locking eyes with a special object takes only a second, and sometimes all I have for self-care is a second. The point is, there's always time to care for and soothe our embodied psyches. What's in your self-care inventory? What do you do when you only have 1 minute, 5 seconds, 2 seconds, 1 second?
Hi, my name is Joe. These are 2 things that I do for self-care are journaling and listening to music. I usually start off with a gratitude journal just to start off with the day. And then later on in the day, I just do some creative writing. And with music, I always find it helps me a lot with my day-to-day and just what my mood is and what I'm listening to definitely helps me, you know, go through about my day.
And that's our episode for this week. Thank you guys so much. I love messaging with all of you guys on Instagram. I've been just really enjoying getting to know all of you and reading your charts. And thank you so much for giving me feedback and telling me the things that you want to hear about on this audio zine. As always, if you want to contribute, please shoot me a message. We're always looking for self-care tips, and we want to hear about your chronic illness, and we want to hear all about mental health. So if you have a story worth sharing, please send it to us, and we will get you on the air. I want to give a voice to everybody. So keep sending me messages, keep interacting. I love you guys. I want to thank first of all, I want to thank Millie for being so generous to talk with us for over an hour on the podcast this week. And I want to thank John for being so vulnerable with his story. John is actually an amazing writer, in addition to being an amazing artist. And he's working on his autobiography right now. So I can't wait until that comes out. And we'll have John on the podcast, I'm sure, to talk all about it. He's led such an extraordinary life. He really is a vision. Go follow him online. You can follow Millie at Debbie_country. And you can follow John online at John Hanning. And you can see all of his beautiful visual art that he's made as well.
Thank you guys so much. We made it through this week. I appreciate it. I am grateful. I have a lot of gratitude. Things are going to get better. And if they're not, then we're just going to hold hands and cry together, you know? All right. See you guys next week. Take care.
Burn Black.